Imagine for a second that you are tasked with building a massive world-class skyscraper.
Okay, I am picturing it.
But there is a major catch here. You have no steel, you have absolutely no glass, no concrete.
Oh, that sounds like a bit of a problem.
Oh, it gets worse.
Yeah.
You are also floating on a tiny raft right in the exact middle of the ocean.
Right, so basically an impossible riddle. You just give up.
Exactly. But today, you and I are looking at the economic equivalent of that exact scenario. We're talking about a geographically isolated island of just 1.3 million people.
And zero natural resources.
Zero. No oil, no ore, no massive river delta, and absolutely no continental hinterland to fall back on.
Yeah, just completely on its own.
And yet this tiny island somehow holds a staggering $705 billion capital portfolio. It acts as the primary financial gateway into the entire continent of Africa.
It is a phenomenal paradox. It really is. And to understand the mechanics of how an economy actually pulls that off, we are turning to a brand new piece of source material.
Yeah, hot off the presses today, right?
Exactly. Published today, June 1st, 2026. It is an excerpt from a new work called The Capital Codex. We are specifically looking at Chapter 3, which is titled Mauritius, Volcanic Rock, and Africa's Private Capital Routing Infrastructure.
It is such a fascinating title.
It is. The author is Doris Odit Achenga. She is the founder of Odit Frontier Partners, which is a firm that specializes in designing what they call adaptive capital systems in volatile markets.
Right, which sounds very intense.
It does, but her insights are incredible. Our mission in this deep dive is to explore a concept she calls the law of intermediary compression.
So we are essentially going to trace how a really brutal history of, well, moving volcanic rock entirely by hand became the blueprint for this massive financial powerhouse.
Precisely. We will look at that cultural and economic blueprint, and then importantly, we have to look at why that very blueprint is suddenly under severe threat today.
Okay, let's unpack this, because reading through this chapter, what struck me immediately is that if you want to understand a $705 billion modern financial engine, you don't actually start by looking at finance.
No, you really don't.
You don't start with banking laws or, like, spreadsheets. The author forces us to rewind all the way to the 19th century and look at literal physical stone.
Yeah, that historical anchor is entirely necessary, to understand the psychology of the modern market there.
So set the scene for us.
Well, the year is 1834. Following the abolition of slavery in the British Empire, a massive influx of indentured laborers begins arriving in Mauritius.
Mostly from India.
Right, primarily from India, yes. They are brought over under these incredibly strict contracts, basically bound to this island, ostensibly to build an agricultural base.
Right.
But when they arrive at the fields, they don't find rolling green pastures. They encounter a landscape defined almost entirely by dense, unyielding volcanic basalt.
Just rocks everywhere.
Everywhere. This stone had cooled from lava over millennia, just sat there on the surface, making cultivation practically impossible physically.
Yeah, the author describes it not just as poor soil, but as, quote, the absence of soil.
Exactly, the absence of soil.
I was trying to picture the sheer scale of that constraint while I was reading. Just imagine being handed a farm you're legally contracted to work.
Right.
But when you show up, the field is practically paved in solid concrete. And to make it worse, you don't even own the land.
You're just a laborer.
Exactly. You're operating under a system designed to extract your labor while limiting your autonomy. I mean, the natural human response to looking at an endless sea of intractable volcanic rock would be to just throw your hands up and say, well, this cannot be done.
That is the logical response, for sure. But what's fascinating here is the author introduces a philosophical concept that emerged from this exact period. She calls it, well, the phrase is, the work was the method.
The work was the method.
Right. These laborers couldn't just wish the rock away. They couldn't plan around it because the stones were too massive and densely packed.
So what do you even do?
The constraint itself had to become the starting point. So using nothing but iron bars to lever the stones loose and, you know, head baskets to carry them and ox carts for the largest boulders, they physically relocated the stone.
Entirely by hand.
Entirely by hand. We are talking about generations of people moving millions of tons of basalt piece by piece.
And what blew my mind is they didn't just dump the rocks into the ocean or like roll them down a hill to get them out of the way.
No, they didn't throw them away at all.
I integrated them.
Yes, they stacked them into what are known as basalt dry stone boundary grids.
Wow.
If you drive through the central plateau of Mauritius today, you still see the physical evidence of this intense manual labor.
thousands of kilometers of these low, dark, hand-stacked volcanic walls still crisscross the landscape.
It's just incredible to visualize.
They took the very thing that prevented growth and they engineered it into the structural boundaries of a new agricultural order.
Yeah.
And by meticulously stripping that rock away, they exposed the red lodosol underneath.
Which is what the soil they actually needed.
Exactly. It's an incredibly iron-rich, fertile, volcanic soil.
So the barren, literal rock became the base for everything that followed. First, the sugar cane grew, then export agriculture took off, the island learned to feed itself, and then the world.
A complete transformation.
But looking at the broader theme of this deep dive, this isn't just an agricultural history lesson for you to memorize. It ingrained a generational reflex.
Right, a cultural habit.
When you are faced with a condition that screams flourishing is impossible here, you don't just accept the adversity. You ask, what can be built from this exact obstacle?
Yes, the text frames it as the ultimate expression of agency under constraint. The volcanic rock dictated that the land couldn't be farmed, so they used the rock to farm it anyway.
It's brilliant.
That built a culture of deliberate construction. They understood very early on that survival wouldn't come from inherited geographic advantages.
Because they simply had none.
Because they had none. Survival depended entirely on the infrastructure they were willing to build themselves.
That sets up the pivot perfectly. Because agriculture, no matter how hard one it is, does not explain how you end up as a 21st century financial titan.
No, it doesn't.
The sugarcane fields don't magically turn into skyscrapers. We hit independence in 1968, and suddenly there is a massive ceiling on the economy.
A very hard ceiling.
Sugarcane alone cannot sustain a modern growing population. The island has no other natural resources left to exploit. So what is their next move when they realize they are geographically stranded in the Indian Ocean?
Well, the new constraint isn't the volcanic rock anymore. It is the ocean itself. It is this extreme geographic isolation.
Right.
They realize they are never going to be a massive continental consumer market. They will never be a global manufacturing hub or a geopolitical center of gravity.
Because they are thousands of miles from the major capital markets like London, New York, or Tokyo.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting. So if you can't be the destination for global capital, you have to become the route.
You become the infrastructure.
You become the infrastructure that the capital uses to get to its destination. But I want to push back on the author's metaphor here just a bit.
Oh, go ahead.
I get the rock analogy, but it feels a little romanticized when we jump to the modern era.
Sure.
Stacking physical stones in a field is completely different from building a complex financial sector out of thin air, especially without any initial financial leverage.
That's a fair point.
How do they actually apply this rock-moving logic in the 1990s? Walk me through the actual mechanics. Like, exactly, how do you translate an iron bar into a financial tool?
Well, you have to think about the function of the tools rather than the physical object itself.
Okay.
In the 19th century, the iron bar and the ox cart were mechanisms to clear friction, literal physical friction in the soil.
Right, getting the rocks out of the way.
But in the late 20th century, the friction wasn't physical anymore. It was legal and financial friction.
I see.
Let's say you are an institutional investor in London, right? And you are looking at a massive infrastructure project in Nairobi in the 1990s.
Okay, I'm the investor.
You see immense potential in that project, but you also see terrifying structural risk.
Right, because if I send my money directly from London to Kenya, I'm dealing with unpredictable tax regimes, currency controls, and shifting local regulations.
Precisely. That is the friction I'm talking about. Let's look at just one specific mechanism, double taxation.
Oh, that's a big one.
Huge. If that UK fund invests directly into Kenya, the profits might be taxed by the Kenyan government and then taxed again by the UK government when the capital is repatriated.
That double hit turns a viable investment into a complete loss.
Exactly. So the modern iron bars used to clear this specific friction were law firms, accounting practices, and deliberate, very aggressive government legislation.
So the equivalent of the cleared, fertile soil.
Are the double taxation agreements, the DTAs.
Okay. That makes sense.
Mauritius systematically negotiated 46 of these bilateral treaties. A DTA is essentially a legal shield.
It protects the investment.
Yes. It ensures that if that UK investor routes their capital through a corporate entity in Mauritius, the tax rights are clearly defined and coordinated between the jurisdictions.
The friction is removed.
Exactly. The capital can now flow into the African continent efficiently.
Okay, I completely follow how the DTAs clear the path like the iron bars, but what about the walls?
The basalt walls?
Yeah, the whole point of the basalt grids was to protect the soil they just uncovered. If you make it incredibly easy for money to flow through your island, aren't you just inviting a massive flood of dirty money? How did they build those walls?
That is exactly where the regulatory framework comes in. And this is vital because if an international financial center becomes a free-for-all for money laundering, the OECD and the FATF, these are the global financial watchdogs, they will blacklist it overnight.
Right, which ruins the whole thing.
So the basalt walls in this modern architecture are the Financial Services Commission, the FSC, and the Global Business Company, or GBC, structures.
So the FSC acts as the physical barrier.
They act as the very strict gatekeepers. Mauritius took the raw materials it had, a stable democracy, a hybrid common and civil legal system, and a highly educated, multilingual professional class.
Which are materials that many comparable island economies just allowed to remain inert.
Exactly. But Mauritius actively legislated them into a fortress of legal certainty. The FSC enforces incredibly strict compliance, anti-money laundering checks, and corporate governance rules for any GBC operating there.
So by keeping the dirty money out, by building those strong walls, they protected the crop of legitimate institutional capital inside.
Yes, they didn't just build a route. They engineered a highly regulated trust architecture.
When you lay out the mechanics like that, the scale of what they achieved makes a lot more sense. We really have to emphasize the data from the text here because it quantifies this trust architecture for you.
The numbers are staggering.
They really are. Out of complete geographic isolation, they engineered a global business portfolio estimated at $705 billion. To put that in perspective for you, that is roughly 50 times the entire domestic GDP of the island itself.
50 times.
Yeah. And this sector created 19,745 direct professional jobs. And by September 2025, the GFCI 38 index, which ranks global financial centers, placed Mauritius at 52nd globally.
Which makes it the highest ranked international financial center in Africa.
Exactly. For three decades, if you were moving serious private capital into the African continent, Mauritius was the default address.
It is the exact same act of construction the author identified in the 1800s.
It really is.
The geographic isolation dictated that this island could not be an economic hub. The Mauritian response was to build a system where the isolation simply didn't matter.
Because the legal and regulatory certainty was so strong.
Exactly. They transformed their marginal position into an essential intermediary layer.
But here is where the narrative takes a pretty dark turn for Mauritius.
Yes, the paradox of the perfect route.
Right. Building the perfect road solves your initial problem. You get the traffic, you get the tolls, you get the jobs. But by working so brilliantly, you prove it can be done.
You show your hand.
Yeah. And once that perfectly paved road is operational, everyone else can clearly see exactly how you built it. The playbook is just out in the open.
This is the exact phenomenon Doris Odit Achinga calls the law of intermediary compression.
So what does this all mean for Mauritius today?
Well, they spent 30 years doing the grueling work of establishing legal predictability, negotiating the treaty network, and building the compliance walls. They absorbed all the initial friction of being the first mover.
Right.
But in doing so, they created a highly visible, highly successful template.
So if I'm a policymaker in Nairobi or Johannesburg today, I don't actually need to invent a trust architecture from scratch.
No, you don't.
I just look at the FSC regulations in Mauritius, I look at the GBC structures, and I import that legal certainty directly into my own domestic market.
That is the core vulnerability of the intermediary. Cities right on the continent, places like Kigali, Nairobi, Johannesburg, alongside massive, heavily capitalized global hubs like Abu Dhabi and Dubai, they're all now laying their own tracks.
They're becoming the route themselves.
Exactly. Kigali, for instance, has been aggressively building the Kigali International Financial Center and actively modeling its legal and regulatory frameworks to attract that exact same cross-border capital.
The logic is undeniable. I mean, if I'm that same investor in London today, and Nairobi has built the exact same legal certainty, the same tax clarity, and the same compliance standards right at the actual destination of the investment.
Why would you detour?
Yeah. Why would I take the geographic detour through an island in the Indian Ocean?
You wouldn't. The trust infrastructure has been commoditized. Historically, financial intermediaries inevitably get bypassed once the destination market matures enough to internalize that trust.
The travelers have learned the route, and they no longer need the guide.
Exactly. So the newest constraint facing Mauritius, the newest rock blocking their path, is not volcanic basalt. And it isn't the Indian Ocean.
It's their own success.
Yes.
They proved the model so well that they essentially made themselves redundant.
The very architecture that created their absolute dominance is the exact architecture the African continent is now actively learning to replicate and build without them.
Wow.
So the question posed by the Capital Codex is no longer whether Mauritius can engineer its way out of a constraint. They have proven they have the cultural muscle memory to do that over and over.
Right. They've done it with stone. They've done it with law.
The critical question now is, what is their next rock? What do they build when the legal and geographic moats have evaporated completely?
That is a really fascinating pivot, and it shifts the focus of this entire deep dive for me. It's not just a case study about an island economy anymore.
No, it's bigger than that.
It's a masterclass in how any system, whether you're running a massive corporate division, managing a startup, or even looking at your own career trajectory, deals with existential constraints.
Absolutely.
If you're an entrepreneur who just had your core product cloned by a massive competitor, you are essentially staring at a field paved in concrete.
That's a great way to look at it.
And the Mauritian blueprint suggests you don't ignore it, and you certainly don't try to wish it away. You have to look at the exact mechanism of your obsolescence and figure out how to use that as the raw material for your next iteration.
It requires a radical honesty about what your current constraints actually are, rather than what you wish they were.
Yeah.
And I want to draw on the specific expertise of our author, Doris Odit Achenga, for a final provocative thought on where this goes next for you to mull over.
Okay, I'm ready.
Her firm focuses intensely on adaptive capital systems in volatile markets and structural uncertainty. Let's track the evolution we've discussed today.
Right. So the first era was physical.
Yes. The first era of innovation was clearing physical stone to expose fertile soil. The second era was clearing geographic isolation by engineering a legal and regulatory hub.
Okay.
But if cities like Kigali and Dubai are successfully mimicking those legal frameworks and physical routes, well, perhaps the next iteration of financial architecture won't rely on geography at all.
Wait, so if geography is no longer the moat and legal frameworks are commoditized, then the new moat has to be adaptability itself.
In a global economy increasingly defined by massive, unpredictable shifts, I'm talking geopolitical realignments, climate shocks, rapid technological displacement, maybe the next basalt wall to conquer isn't a physical place or a lack of natural resources.
And what is it?
Maybe the new constraint is structural uncertainty itself. The provocation the author leaves us with is this. Can an economic system learn to build permanent, compounding infrastructure out of pure market volatility?
Wow.
Can you engineer a financial architecture that is entirely untethered from any specific island or continent and instead uses volatility itself as the raw material for growth?
Building the skyscraper out of the storm itself instead of worrying about the raft.
Precisely.
That is a brilliant and challenging place to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. As you navigate your own professional landscapes this week, take a hard look at the obstacles you're facing. Find the rock in your path, figure out its exact dimensions, and ask yourself how you can stack it to build your own infrastructure. We'll catch you next time.